Hello, my name is Anne-Marie Cannon, and I'm the host of Armchair Historians. What's your favorite history? Each episode begins with this one question. Our guests come from all walks of life. YouTube celebrities, comedians, historians, even neighbors from the small mountain community that I live in. They're people who love history and get really excited about a particular time, place, or person from our distant or not-so-distant past. The jumping-off point is the place where they became curious, then entered the rabbit hole into discovery. Fueled by an unrelenting need to know more, we look at history through the filter of other people's eyes. Armchair Historians is a Belgian Rabbit production. Stay up to date with us through Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Wherever you listen to your podcast, that is where you'll find us. Armchair Historians is an independent, commercial-free podcast. If you'd like to support the show and keep it ad-free, you can buy us a cup of coffee through Ko-fi, or you can become a patron through Patreon. Links to both in the episode notes. Hello, fellow armchair historians, and welcome to another episode. I'd like to start off this episode by thanking all of our supporters. You know who you are, and it means the world to us. You can find more out about supporting this show on our webpage, www.armchairhistorians.com. You can also like our show and join the conversation on social media as well. Every little bit helps us to come up in the algorithms. In this episode, I talked to Andrew Nagorski about his new book, Saving Freud, The Rescuers Who Brought Him to Freedom. The book recounts the dramatic true story of Sigmund Freud's last-minute escape to London following the German annexation of Austria, why he waited until after the Nazi takeover, and the colorful cast of characters who persuaded and extricated him from his beloved Vienna to London. Andrew is an award-winning journalist and author who spent more than three decades as a foreign correspondent and editor for Newsweek. From 2008 to April 2014, he was vice president and director of public policy for the East-West Institute, an international affairs think tank. Nagorski is now based in St. Augustine, Florida, but continues to travel extensively, writing for numerous publications. His recent books include Hitlerland, American Eyewitnesses to the Nazi Rise to Power, The Nazi Hunters, and 1941, the year Germany lost the war. Andrew Nagorski, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What's your favorite history that we're going to be talking about today?
Well, if you're talking about a period of history, the period that most interests me is the early part of the 20th century. From World War I to World War II, the rise of the totalitarian movements, the rise of Hitler, the Bolshevik Revolution. And it's not just because, I mean, I've worked in both Germany and Russia, the old Soviet Union, as a foreign correspondent, and much of that area before. And so there's a fascination with how did these horrible systems get their hold on people and then were able to commit the crimes that they did on such a massive scale. But I think it's a question of those particular places, the history, but it's also, it raises questions about human nature, basic human psychology, and what it is about human beings that they allow themselves to get swept up into such demonic systems. And so that's general area is where I'm always most interested, and I find it endlessly fascinating to read not only histories, the good histories of that period, whether William Shirer's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich or Robert Conquest, The Great Terror about the Soviet Union, but particularly personal accounts and very vivid memoirs, correspondence from the time. I mentioned William Shirer, the famous historian of the Third Reich, who was a CBS correspondent in the 30s. His Berlin diary, to me, is even more revealing because it provides the details of his early to everyday life. And I particularly like to think about these people. What were they doing at the time? What were they observing at the time? What did they understand at the time? And I happened to be a correspondent in that part of the world when it was still with the Cold War. And it's always easy to look back in retrospect and say, oh, we should have understood that this and this was going to happen. And eventually, you know, the Berlin Wall really was going to crumble and the Soviet Union was going to implode. And while all those things occurred to me at times, I can't say I was a prophet by any means. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of it is, I think we look back and look, for instance, at the rise of Hitler and how was it possible to ignore all those signals? And what were the circumstances that drove people to back someone like Hitler? Mm. Those things always fascinated me, even before you get to the point about people's behavior, about the moral choices you make in situations like that, which is, of course, is even more complicated. In retrospect, we all want to think we'd be heroes. Mm-hmm. Well, and that we would have understood everything. I'd be very careful about making those kinds of conclusions.
I agree. You've written several books about Hitler and the Third Reich, and specifically, you are releasing a new book, and it's about that time period, but tell us a little bit about the new book, the name of it, and what it's about.
My new book is called Saving Freud, The Rescuers Who Brought Him to Freedom. Now, I never intended to write a book about Freud, frankly. Yeah, he's such an iconic figure. And I think we all think, oh, we kind of understand who Freud was and what psychoanalysis is. I took Psych 101 in college, so I must know something. But here's how the process worked for me. I was reading a memoir in this period between books when I'm looking for subjects of a Austrian Jewish writer by the name of Stefan Zweig, who is a brilliant writer, very popular of novels, novellas, short stories at the turn of the century. And his memoir is very evocative of Vienna in the early 20th century. And at one point, he describes how he meets Freud in Vienna and gets to know him a little bit. Freud is already a pretty celebrated figure at that point. And then in 1934, Zweig has the good sense to get out of Vienna, realizing, you know, what's happening next door in Germany with Hitler coming to power in 33 is bad news for Jews, not just in Germany, but everywhere.
Yeah.
Freud stays. And the next time Zweig sees Freud is in London in 1938, after he's managed to escape, which is a big part of the story of my book, which he talks to him again. And I'm thinking, well, first of all, there's a story there about Freud that's not commonly known. Mm-hmm. What was going on? Why did he stick mm-hmm. around in mm-hmm. Vienna so late? And then how did he get out of Vienna? And why did he end up in mm-hmm. London?
Mm-hmm.
Then I began to read various memoirs and letters. Luckily, Freud wrote endless letters, which is one of the real blessings for a historian of that period, is the way people wrote letters then. I don't think emails and text messages are going to cut it in the same way, you know, for future historians. And I sort of, in some ways, I feel their pain, because those letters, when you read them, the amount of descriptions, beautifully written, but they, again, give you a sense of not how you should view this in retrospect, but how these people were living their lives at the time and what they saw, felt. And then you begin to understand, you may think they still miscalculated and made wrong decisions, but you become a little less judgmental. And I was not trying to be judgmental. I was trying to describe this whole period. And I also happen to love Vienna, and I've gone back and forth there many times during my postings to Central and Eastern Europe. And I could understand Freud's attachment to Vienna. And so that got me into it. The question of how did he get out also raised the question of who were the people who got him out? Because by the time Freud is getting out, he's over 80 and mm-hmm. he's sick. He's got cancer of the jaw. And then I realized there's this whole stable of close friends and professional associates who he's developed over his lifetime. And you could not figure out a better cast of characters in terms mm-hmm. of, well, first of all, there's his youngest daughter, Anna Freud, who later becomes a famous psychoanalyst, and she stays at home when all his other kids leave the home. and she's his protector and professional colleague. But then there's Ernest Jones, who's a Welsh psychiatrist who became entranced by Freud and becomes his bigger spokesman in the English-speaking world, and who also has various scandals, let us say, because he's a very small man, full of energy, very hardworking, and always manages to, let's say, get involved in situations which today, as they would say in the politically correct age, I doubt he would have survived. But he's accused of various sexual crimes and so forth. He usually gets off the hook, but it's close. And he's incredibly dedicated to Freud. There's Marie Bonaparte,
who is an interesting character.
The great grandniece of Napoleon. So her great grandfather was Napoleon's brother. And she also happened to marry the Prince of Greece and Denmark. So she's royalty and she's got money, but she's sexually frustrated. That takes her to Freud. Yeah. You know, not surprisingly, a lot of the people who come to Freud have various problems, and often sexual problems. And there's William Bullitt, the U.S. ambassador to France from a very famous Philadelphia family, who had been a famous journalist and author too before. So you have all these people who are at the key moment when Freud is really in danger. They rally around. And my book sort of develops these characters. Yeah, Freud is a central character, but orbiting around him is this entourage. And then how all of those people come together to get him out I found it really interesting, because that whole tableau of Central Europe in the beginning of the last century, in the 20s, 30s, when Hitler has come to power, is something I'm largely familiar with from my previous research. But this cast of characters was totally new to me. For me, this book was a great adventure.
Yeah, and my undergraduate degree was in social work. I was a social worker for 10 years. And, of course, I studied all of the behavioral sciences. And I think every single class we covered Freud. And so when I saw the book and I started reading about it and reading it, I was really surprised at all these things you just talked about that you brought to light. You really focus in on something that I think is very different than what we know. And it also develops Freud's personality, because you see the people who he's influenced, how much they care about him, the things, the lengths that they're going to help him. I think that's fascinating. And also, I do appreciate what you said earlier about the everyday life, you know, of these big events, of the people who are living them. I think that is where we have in the future, in the present, to draw upon the history and to understand it better from all those different points of view. I think that is much more fascinating than the big battles and, you know, all the things like that. Why was Freud so resistant to leave, even after the invasion, the takeover of Austria by the Nazis? Why was he so resistant to leave? He was 81 years old. You say in the book that he was in denial. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, I think, well, first of all, one thing that I try to explain in the book is that growing up, he was born in 1856. So he grew up in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It wasn't Austria alone, as it would be later, but this multinational empire of about 50 million people in various minorities. And he felt a real affection for that empire. Yes, there was plenty of anti-Semitism, nationalist movements. Of course, later on, the Balkans, the part of the empire, would spark the feuds there, would spark World War I. But he had a pretty good life in Vienna, and he felt quite loyal to it. And he was interesting also in terms of his Jewish identity. He was a non-believer. He was not observant at all. But he never renounced his Jewish identity. He always said, you know, this is part of my heritage. And he said, I'm never going to walk away from it. And in fact, when a few times in life where he was confronted with anti-Semites directly, he did not back down an inch. So he was a person who then built up his life, and he's a man of very set habits. He's known as a revolutionary thinker for his time. The whole notion of psychoanalysis, the subconscious, of these instincts, these sexual drives and how they play out in humans, at the time it was very shocking to people. But the flip side of that, which most people didn't realize, was that in his own life, he could be very conventional. He was married for more than 50 years to the same woman. He had his family. He had a very strict regimen about when he got up and when his barber would come and trim his beard and his meals, the times for receiving patients, for writing, for going to the cafes and reading newspapers. And so I think he understood intellectually, especially towards the end of World War I, how his world was falling apart. At first, he underestimated what World War I would be. He thought it might be a local conflict. And then he was horrified by the dimensions of the conflict and the savagery. And then he had no illusions once he saw the rise of the Bolshevik Revolution in the Soviet Union and then the rise of the Nazis, that people were capable of horrible things. He wrote this essay, Civilization and Its Discontents, in 1930, where he talked about the savagery of man. Mm. And yet, he didn't want to believe it would impede his life and his rituals. And that's, I think, very human. I mean, for one thing, he thought the Austrians had their own brand of fascism in the 30s, but it was much more mild. The Austrian regimes tried to keep Hitler at bay. Of course, in the end, that completely failed, and one of the chancellors was assassinated by the Nazis. Then he was preoccupied with the fact that he was old. He had cancer of the jaw out of his famous cigar smoking. And so he thought, maybe I can just ride this out at least till the end of my life and whatever happens next. So he really did kind of put his head down and was in large part in denial. And that's a story that I developed there. And it would take these friends to sort of say, look, shake him, say, you can't be in denial. And what really, in the end, convinced him that he had to go was the fact that especially Anna, his youngest daughter, was in danger. I explain all of that, including Gestapo's actions in the book. And he realized, look, we old people, referring to himself and his wife, yeah, maybe it doesn't make sense for us to move, but if we don't move, she's not moving, yeah. So we have to move.
That's interesting because that resonated with me, especially this resistance of him to leave, because my mother was born in Belgium, not mm-hmm. Jewish, although when we did her DNA, there is Ashkenazi's Jew in her DNA, but somebody took a pass yeah. somewhere or something like that. But,
well, in so many European families, that's true. Yes, yeah. yeah.
So in World War II, my great-grandmother, my mother was actually living with at 8 years old when her father went off to fight for France. She wouldn't leave in World War II. Belgium, which is kind of shocking because of what they went through in World War I, and of course she was alive, and there's a whole family tragedy that I'm working on a documentary about in Belgium in World War I. And then to World War II, but she wouldn't leave. But the thing was, is that my grandmother wouldn't leave without her mother. And this so resonated with me because finally, at the very last minute, the Germans are coming into Belgium and she finally decides to leave. And the family legend is that they left on the last train leaving Belgium, which is the name of the documentary
yes.
that is one day going to come out. Of course, they end up, you know, in a refugee camp in France and being occupied anyways, but that's a whole other story. But that story, and you talk about the personal stories, that story resonated with me. And I could it's almost like I could imagine Freud being tired. And I'm sure that my great-grandmother was as well. She ends up going back to Belgium after the occupation. That really resonated with me.
That's a great title.
Finally, he decides to go for the same reason that I think my great-grandmother did as well, because of her kids and her grandchildren. Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, I don't want you to talk too much because I want people to buy the book. It's a magnificent book.
Yes.
So he decides to stay the occupation happens, and personally, what happens to him and his family when the Nazis come in and how they treat him.
First of all, I'll backtrack for 1 second to your family story. My family story is it happens to be from in Poland, not Belgium, but my father was called up as a young man when the Germans invaded and then managed to escape, as my grandparents did too, and my mother did. They had just been married. And so he was in Polish forces. Of course, after a month, Polish forces had to surrender. And then rather than surrender to a POW camp, he managed to escape and eventually ended up in France, where Polish forces were regrouping. Then France falls and they are evacuated by the British, and he's in Polish forces under British command. So we all have, I think, family stories. And one of the reasons so many of us, I think, have a fascination with this, that we can trace back. And so much. And for me, it was very vivid. I was born in Scotland after the war because my father and my parents had stayed there for a couple of years. And then I came to the States when I was a baby, which accounts for my heavy Scottish accent. But I think we all, many people could trace back these stories. So they resonate on any number of levels. And then but with Freud and his situation where he was still almost passive at a certain point. But what happens is, and the first day that Hitler actually shows up in Vienna to make a speech declaring that the Austrian state no longer exists and it's now part of the Third Reich, these Nazi thugs arrive both at the Freud's apartment and at the psychoanalytic publishing house, which is up the street and very close by. They are threatened by these thugs and extorted, and the first instinct is just get what money you can. And there's a very well detailed description of what happens and the behavior of Martha Freud, who's also the wife who is such a strong figure and often I think underestimated, and how she treats these invaders. At that point, also this what I call rescue squad kicks in, including Ernest Jones, the British psychologist, who's at that point the head of the International Psychoanalytic Society. He manages to get to Vienna and talk to Freud, and they have a discussion, what's happening, and he begins to convince Freud that, look, this Austria that you lived in is no longer the Austria that you love, obviously, and you're in danger. And any doubts that Freud had remaining dissipated as soon as they began to interrogate, especially Anna Freud, his daughter. And then it becomes a desperate search for how do we get the Nazis to free us, to allow us to emigrate, because it wasn't sure. Remember, this is before the Holocaust, but the anti-Semitism is part of all official policy, and there's no ambiguity about that. And it's unclear, what are they going to do to famous families, and especially rich families like they consider the Freuds? And they appointed a Nazi trustee, what they call them, somebody to come in and assess what these families have, and then basically to extort as much money as possible, and then decide, are we going to let them go or not? So all of this is at play when they come in. And it takes a couple of months, and there are several dramas along the way, and an unexpected twist also from the Nazi overseer, who is another interesting character in my book, who at first I knew nothing about, first get the permission to get him out. And then there was a question also, where do they go? Because at that point, most countries were not about to fling their doors open to Jewish refugees from the Third Reich. And even famous ones like the Freuds. And it was, again, this man, Ernest Jones, who uses every connection he has in England to get them entry permits to England, which was quite a feat.
There's so many, like we said already, interesting characters and twists of fate, and it just makes it such a compelling story. And each character that you talk about, there could be a memoir or a biography written about each one of those their involvement in this and their motivations and all the things and what they experienced. So It's not just about Freud. It's not just an interesting story about how he left and why he left. It's also about these fascinating characters. Why this history? You talked about your fascination with that time period, but why this history?
For one thing, as soon as I sort of tripped over this mention of Freud in Vienna, then how he reappears in London, I say, okay, I don't know this story. So I was just curious. And then I started reading up about these characters. And I thought, I'm always fascinated by this period, but it's always difficult to figure out what is a new approach, something that will give a reader a fresh perspective and introduce new people. Because we've had, in fact, before I started writing my books about the Third Reich, I was a Newsweek correspondent in Germany, and I'd written various stories about the legacy of the Third Reich and even interviewed some of the people who were involved in it, the Nazi hunters and so forth. But I was hesitant to write books about that period because I think there are these great books like The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, Scheirer and others. But then I realized there are always new stories, new perspectives. And this struck me, the more I dug into it, that this is that small pieces of this story have surfaced in various places before, but I never seen it put together.
Mm.
Any writer likes a good story that really does have really rich, complex characters and a trajectory where you feel you're learning about these characters and inhabiting their world,
mm-hmm.
learning a lot about them, but learning a lot about the times. Because I think Freud and these characters are in and of themselves fascinating, but it also is a barometer of what's happening in this whole period in the world, especially in Europe, but in the United States as well.
Yeah, and I feel like Vienna is also like a character in the book as well. And I love that about it. You do a marvelous job in doing all those things you just talked about. At one point, Anna says, wouldn't it be better if we all committed suicide?
Yes,
she
does.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
That's at the moment, that first day when the Nazis have broken into their home and into the office of the printing press, and where Anna and Martha felt compelled to take whatever cash they had at hand and give it to these thugs, because it was somewhat a disorganized invasion yet, but they knew that the next step is going to be much more systematic. Then people did not yet know what exactly was in store. Again, you can say in retrospect, everyone should do from the beginning when Hitler wrote Mein Kampf, his language very much suggested the horrors to come. But there were such horrors that it was hard for rational people to get their mind around it and to say he means it literally. We always have a tendency to excuse the extremists, the real murderers, saying, oh, this is a figure of speech, you're only talking to your base. This was for real, but even someone like Freud found it hard to accept that, in terms that it would directly impinge on his personal life. So when Anna, though, at that point, suddenly she and her parents are confronted by these invaders, and they say, we're coming back. They just had taken the first round, and the situation looks desperate. And how are we ever going to survive this? That's when, in despair, she says, wouldn't it be better if we all committed suicide?
Yeah, that really brings out the bleakness of that situation for her and for them.
Yeah, at that point, it's no longer possible to live in the illusion that somehow we can go on with life as normal.
Yeah. So one of the things that we talked about is the biggest thing is that he escapes. And that we don't really know this story. This is a fresh perspective on Freud's life and what happened to him. And I think that his escape is probably the reason why we don't really focus too much on that, is because if he would have been one of the victims of the Holocaust, it would have been his life's work would have been seen in a very different light, I think. And that would have always been a side note or exclamation point at the end of the sentence. it would have been that. And I think the fact that he did get out, and even though he didn't live that much longer after the escape, I think that made his work maybe more studied the way that I had to study it in every single class that I took in college in my undergraduate. So I was just kind of piecing that together when we were talking. So one of the questions that I always ask is, where do we see this history in popular culture?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, look at popular culture. Once I started on the Freud book, I was aware that Freud and Freudian, of course, Freudian slips and mm-hmm. Freud smoking his cigar and mm-hmm. so forth. Everyone knows those terms, those symbols, but it's amazing how it saturated the popular culture and psychoanalysis, of course. Because I lived most of the 80s and the 90s as a foreign correspondent, I was not in the United States, I missed certain things in the popular culture, like okay. The Sopranos, for instance. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now, after all this time, I'm catching up on it with my wife. And there it is. Of course, there's the psychoanalysts and their constant references to Freud. Freud has become such a symbol of... That's, I think, one of the reasons why I also became really fascinated with him, because I recognize that my own understanding of Freud, of how he started, how he even developed the whole notion of psychoanalysis, was very superficial and almost non-existent in some of the other part of his life. So I think while the rescue, the escape, is, of course, the culmination of my book, I tried in my book also to convey how he developed professionally and personally, and why he went in the direction he did in terms of his thinking and his practice. And that in itself is also really interesting. And the popular culture, you know, movie after movie and TV show and books, when I'm working on various projects, I pick up various thrillers or things just as a mind diversion. Mm-hmm. And I picked up an old Jack Higgins novel, if you know the British writer Jack Higgins, who wrote a whole bunch of thrillers in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. There's immediately a scene with Freud, and where he's talking about Freud. Mm-hmm. Freud himself became popular part of the popular culture while he was alive. H.G. Wells met Freud.
Oh, wow.
Early on, H.G. Wells was writing kind of light novels about, it wasn't science fiction yet. And he has a novel where his main character is traveling with a psychoanalyst who's clearly a stand-in for Freud. Uh-huh. So once you become aware of it, you know, in my life, of course, when I'm working on a book, is totally consumed by these characters. I feel like I'm almost living with them. And then you look around and every other reference seems to be something related to Freud.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I never know what the answer is going to be when I ask that question. Sometimes people are really stumbled by that, but that was a great answer. And it's really conjured up a lot of, well, I did watch The Sopranos in real time. So
yes, and, yes.
You say in one point, in spite of understanding on a deep level, quote, the dark forces propelling his world to mass murder, he was in denial. And then you also reference the work that he did during World War One, but you do, through this, kind of draw out this reality that he knew, but he didn't want to know.
Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. What one thing do you want people to know about, to remember about this history? If there was only one thing, what would you like them to remember?
Well, specifically about Freud or about this period?
About the work and about the story that you bring out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one thing is that even the most insightful people, the most people who really understand a tremendous amount. And Freud, I came to greatly respect him both as a man and a thinker. Freud is no longer the flavor of the month in terms of, you know, most psychiatrists, they say, yeah, there was Freud, but of course we're way beyond that and all that. Well, I think almost all psychiatry, psychology, can be traced back to Freud and Freud's ideas, even when they are rejecting some of them. And so I think the role of Freud is huge, and he really was probably the biggest celebrity of that era. And yet he was in many ways a modest man. He had very big ambitions, but in his everyday life, he, as I mentioned, he was very conservative. And even politically, he was much more conservative than many of his peers when, for instance, that was a period when there was a lot of fascination among intellectuals in the United States and Europe with the Bolshevik Revolution, with communism. And Freud would say, this is a system that allows no individual liberty. It's the herd mentality. Don't get caught up in it. Mm-hmm. And so those are lessons I think we could all learn and absorb, that do not go blindly with the crowd, whichever extreme that crowd mm-hmm. is going in, whichever direction mm-hmm. that crowd is going in. Mm. You need yes. to retain, and that the individual is the center, not the state.
That's really profound. Yeah.
And your conscience, he was not a religious man, but as he said, I feel that I'm a moral man. Mm-hmm. And you know, my parents did teach me that there are choices in life and that you have to lead a proper life. And even though he was very non-judgmental about, you know, of course, many of his patients led a life which then, especially then, but even now, might not be considered proper in any way. But he was non-judgmental about his patients and the things that they did. But in terms of his own life and in what he expected of others, that he would respect, that he wanted people who could think for themselves, think out for themselves, mm-hmm. and not blindly accept the dictates of any ideology. So those are, I think, that a man emerged and lived through that period, he did have a strong moral compass. And that, I guess, part of my fascination with that period is always who did retain a moral compass. Mm. It's hard to see often.
Yeah. Well put. That is well put. Is there anything that I didn't ask you that you wanted to share with my audience?
I hope these individuals will come to life for readers. Mm-hmm. Because that, my feeling is, the way you tell a story, if you're telling it well, is by showing the people, the action and so forth, rather than telling people what they should think about the right. people and the action. And that's what I try to do in my book here.
You do that very well.
Yeah. Thank you.
Where can we find you? And where can we find the book?
Well, the book will be out everywhere starting August 23rd. And it's already available, obviously, for pre-order on, you know, in all the typical websites, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, the various independent bookstores. My website.
There's also an audiobook that's going to be available, because I do a lot of audiobooks and I went in to look and see. So a lot of people who listen to my podcast are probably more listeners than readers. So that's also another option.
And my website, where a lot of the information about my book is andrewnagorski.com. And I also, I'm on Facebook and on Twitter. Follow or friend me on Facebook. And I'm always open to, through my website, you can contact me if they have specific questions or requests.
And I'll link out to all those places as well in our episode notes. Andrew Nagorski, thank you for being here today. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Anne-Marie, it's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed some of your, not just questions, but reflections. So thanks for having me on.
There you have it, Andrew Nagorski in Saving Freud. To find out more about Andrew and the book, be sure to check out our episode notes. Thanks for joining us, and have a great week.